Good morning. Thank you for coming to this morning's session of Sunstone West. You are at session number 5 of this conference, Tell Eve About the Serpent, a qualitative study of the effects of temple experiences, effects of temple participation in the lives of young adult Mormons. Our speaker today is Janet Kincaid, who's the author of the thesis. And she has received her master's in religion and society from the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. Her area of specialty is the sociology of Mormonism, and her sub-area is in Islamic life in America. Her primary drive is to learn the language of faith and to discover the need religion fills in the lives of individuals. To that end, it is not uncommon to find Janet not only in her own church, but in other churches, enjoying a vast array of liturgical and spiritual wealth. Janet possesses the typical Mormon resume, lifelong membership, numerous and sundry callings, mission service in Austria in the late 80s and early 90s, temple ordinance worker in the Washington, D.C. temple, and so forth. A resident of Walnut Creek, California, and expatriate of Fairfax, Virginia, Janet works as a managing editor for a B2B company in San Francisco and publishes reports for the pulp and paper industry. Responding to this paper will be Dickens. He is originally from both Seattle and Salt Lake City. After serving a mission in Southern California, decided to stay here. So after starting off at Brigham Young University, he transferred to the University of Southern California. At the USC Film School, he's received his master's in screenwriting and directing, and he currently writes, directs, and produces in the Los Angeles area. At this time, he serves as Elders Quorum President and Choir Director, and is married with 3 kids and a dog. And he tells me that despite his long hair, he does have a testimony. So we'll first hear Janet Kincaid, and after a response from Jeff Parkins, we'll save some time for questions towards the end. So Janet, please.
Good morning. It's not in my nature to stand behind things and behind microphones, so if I venture out there, throw things at me. First of all, I want to thank a number of people who put together the symposium, Mary Ellen Robertson, Donae Tidwell, Brian Madsen, all the people at Sunstone, Todd Compton, and I appreciate their willingness to let me be here today. I do have a time constraint. Unfortunately, immediately following this session, I have to leave. I have to be in Berkeley at 6 o'clock this evening for dinner and a reception with the dean of my college. I'll be graduating next week, so technically I don't have my degree yet, but humor me and make me think I'm, you know, special. What I want to do is just very quickly figure out my audience here. By show of hands, how many of you are not LDS? Okay. How many of you have been members less than 1 year? Less than 5 years? Less than 10 years? 20? 30? Okay, all your lives? You've been members all your lives? Okay. I ask that just because there's a certain portion of my presentation that I wrote as groundwork for people who are not LDS. I never assume in my writing that people will understand Mormonism. Unfortunately, because we're still a very young tradition, there's still a great deal of background work that has to be laid in order for people to understand some of the phenomena of our culture and our rich life, and particularly where temple is concerned. So the first chapter of my thesis gives a history of the temple as understood by Mormons, beginning with the Enuma Elish flood creation myth, which is essentially a very old epic tale about how the earth came into being, that essentially the gods and the waters had a battle, and the gods came out victorious, and what emerged out of the waters was then land, which became known as primordial space. And this became sacred space. And so this is seen among religious historians and sociologists of religions often as the beginning of sacred space versus profane space. I then continue on and talk briefly, and only very briefly, about temples throughout the history of the world, and again, as understood by Mormons. This includes a discussion of the tabernacle in the wilderness that was erected by Moses. I also posit the argument that we could say that the altar that Adam and Eve built once they were expelled from the garden was the first instance of a temple, We can even go back one step and say that the Garden of Eden itself was a temple. It was a place wherein Adam and Eve dwelt with God and talked with God, much as we believe the purpose of temples is today, or one of the purposes. So that's essentially the first chapter. I also continue and talk about the history of temples in and the beginnings of temples, starting in Kirtland with the Kirtland Temple, and talking briefly about Nauvoo, and then discussing temples in the modern era. So I won't go into a lot of discussion about that. However, if there are any questions about the nature or the theology behind temples, the two people in the back that indicated they were not LDS, if you have any questions, please, by all means, throw them out there. I'm going to assume that the rest of you understand what I mean when I say temple. One of the theories that I hope to develop out of this work is that temple is extraordinary worship, which is a term that I have coined, I think. I haven't found it anywhere else, so I'm taking it as my own. And extraordinary worship has four aspects. First of all, in order for something to be extraordinary worship, it has to be highly individualized worship. It cannot be corporate worship. It's something that's very personal. It's not like your typical church on Sunday, meeting with a congregation in a corporate setting. The second element is that there must be an extreme amount or degree of inaccessibility. It must be difficult to go, either logistically, in other words, you have to go out of your way to get there. It's not just around the corner, or it's not just within a couple of square miles. It's literally something that takes an hour to several hours to even days to get to, as the case is for some members who live in South America and have to travel down the Amazon, literally 3 or 4 days just to get to the temple. And the comparison that I make is with Islamic Hajj, that in order to go to Hajj in Mecca, you have to travel to Saudi Arabia, to Mecca, to participate in Hajj. You can't just create your own little Hajj in your neighborhood or whatever. So again, this inaccessibility. In conjunction with that, you must be credentialed. And again, the comparison holds with Hajj as well. You have to prove that you're Muslim. You often have to show papers from an imam stating that you're Muslim. So again, this theory holds with Mormon temple, that you must have temple recommend, that credential that says you've met certain requirements within the Mormon church of moral chastity, you're paying your tithing, you support your church leaders, so on and so forth. And so just simply being Mormon doesn't mean you can go to temple. Simply being Muslim doesn't mean you can go to Mecca. The third element is that the form and the location are different from regular worship. Again, although the theological undertones may be the same, the actual performance and the actual location of the ritual is completely different and distinct from regular worship settings. As we all know, Mormon temple buildings are very cookie-cutter. You all know where the restroom is, whether you're in Altadena or Vienna, Austria. You're going to know, I got to go to the bathroom, this is where it's going to be. Temples are a little more unique. You have to get a map. I know when I worked in the Washington, D.C. temple, it took me a month to finally figure out, oh, wait a minute, if I want to use the women's room without walking around the entire celestial room, thus arriving at the same point that I was at when I started, I just need to go right instead of left. So getting yourself oriented for each temple is a little different. But more important than just the architectural form or the setting is what goes on there, the liturgy that takes place there. Again, Mormon temple worship is rather businesslike. It's fairly exciting in a liturgical sense, unless you have a really rousing choir, like the one in Jeff Parkin's ward in Altadena. Little plug, which I would travel to Altadena just to hear. But aside from that, it's a fairly simple service compared to other religious traditions. However, temple is incredibly liturgic and extremely liturgic, and it's the first experience that the majority of Mormons have with any form of high liturgy. So, again, the location and the form are different from regular worship. And the last point is that it changes the member status. And again, I make the comparison here with people who participate in Hajj. Once they have been to Hajj, they are designated as a pilgrim. And they are seen from then on as someone significant because they have gone to Mecca and have participated in Hajj. And in the same way, as Mormons, we seem to know who is and who isn't endowed. And we seem to know this through interesting little things. It's little things like jargon. You know, we're standing around. I'll give you an example. I'm standing in my ward in Berkeley about 2 years ago, and my friend Craig is looking for his son, Adam. And so he's standing in the middle of the chapel, and he goes, "Adam, Adam." And all of the rest of us stand there going, meanwhile, everybody who isn't endowed has no clue. They're like, whatever. Oh, where's Adam? We got to find Adam. They have no clue. The rest of us who have been endowed have a clue. And we're all standing around going, wherefore art thou? which, by the way, is in Scripture, may I just say on the record. So again, these little things like jargon, or, you know, we'll candidly make a little joke like, well, I'll tell you if you know the secret handshake. Which, you know, I'm not going there. And a person who has not been to the temple has no idea what we're talking about. We'll read scripture in Sunday school, passages from the Pearl of Great Price or the Old Testament, and we'll have a discussion about Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden. And those of us who have been to the temple understand the deeper theological significance of what's being discussed. And people who haven't been to the temple just think we're having a regular Sunday school discussion. There's really no more deeper meaning for it or in it for them than there is for us. And so again, these are some of the things that when our status changes, we are in the know. And we become part of an exclusive, what some people would call a little club. I won't say that, at least not here. So, anyway, my study was, the temple is something that I love and that has always fascinated me. And as Leslie mentioned in introducing me, I spent some time as a temple ordinance worker in Washington, D.C., in the D.C. temple, for about 18 months shortly after my mission. And I spent 10 of those months as the initiatory director, and I absolutely loved it. I think it's, aside from my mission and aside from college and my master's degree, it was one of the best things and one of the funnest things I ever did, and I had just a wonderful time. So, as a senior in college, I asked the question, does Temple create cohesion? And I wrote this lovely paper that I will sheepishly admit I forced to show that Temple creates cohesion. In point of fact, it does not. And I realized that after I wrote the paper and submitted it, and the professor came back to me and said, you know, I think you're really trying too hard here, but it's a nice effort, and I'll give you an A anyway. And have a happy life. Good luck at the Graduate Theological Union. So off I went. And in sitting down and talking with my advisor, who coincidentally is a member of the RLDS Church, we decided that what I should do is what I know. And at the time, what I knew was the temple. And so for two very arduous years, another professor and I spent time trying to decide how can we discuss or how can I write about this topic and narrow it down. I mean, it was huge. It was so big. And we finally narrowed it down, and I thought we narrowed it down, but in point of fact, it's still huge. But we did get it narrowed down from what it was before. And what we decided we would do is a qualitative study. The first study had been quantitative. I'd done surveys and had just kind of briefly talked with people that didn't do anything beyond that. So we decided that we would actually ask people what their experience were with the temple and what the effects of temple participation were in their lives. I'm an editor and I can't even figure out which one I want. Anyway, so we developed an interview protocol, and I sent out an announcement to three wards in the Bay Area. One of the wards was strictly a student singles ward in Berkeley. The other was a student family ward, also in Berkeley. And the last ward was just a family ward of very mixed age in Lafayette, California, which is about 25 miles east of San Francisco. And I chose these three wards for a variety of reasons. I wanted to test a couple of things. First of all, I wanted to see if people would talk to me, first and foremost. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go with a ward that I live in, where people know me, they're familiar with me, they know my little quirks and, you know, my nuances, and they're comfortable with that, and we'll do that. Then I go with a ward where I know people who live in the ward, but I also don't know people who live in the ward, and see if anyone responds, and see who responds and why. And then I'm going to go with a ward where I know absolutely no one, and I've only been there once, and it's made up of all of these, and please pardon me, little blue-haired grandmas. So, who all live at Rossmore. Well, it's not the whole ward's not, but a good portion of it is. So I wanted to see how people would respond. Again, given the stigma and the taboo that surrounds Temple and the fact that we don't talk about it, I wanted to see if people would actually be open to maybe being interviewed about the effects of the Temple. So I placed announcements in the ward bulletins of these three wards and received 17 responses, all from the Berkeley University ward, which was the ward I was in, and then the Berkeley Family Ward. And out of those 17 responses, we finally had 12 interviews. And all 12 people that I interviewed knew me personally, so or knew of me. I should say that a couple of the people that I interviewed, I didn't interact with on a social basis, whereas a number of the people that I interviewed, we were also rather good friends and we interacted socially. So anyway, that kind of proved my theory that, you know, Mormons won't talk about Temple unless it feels safe or seems safe. And that sounds so weird. So interviewed in the Bay Area 12 men and women of various marital status. A number of them were single. One was divorced, had been married twice. And then several of us were married. And the ones that were married, I actually interviewed couples. So I interviewed one woman who was living in Washington, D.C., who I had met through an email list and who had just been to the temple and really, really, really wanted to participate, begged me. And I happened to be in town one weekend for my birthday, so I agreed to interview her. So what I'd like to do right now is talk briefly about what came out of my research and what my findings were, which is why you're all here 20 minutes later. Some interesting things happened. First of all, I asked four questions because I wanted to find out what people were integrating in terms of Sunday school lessons, literature, and so in particular I focused on Boyd K. Packer's The Holy Temple and Michael Wilcox's House of Glory. One being more authoritative than the other, or seen as more authoritative, the other written by your run-of-the-mill general Mormon, but basically telling you what your experience in the temple should be. So I wanted to see how people were integrating theology and material in their lives. So the first question I asked everyone to answer is, what is the purpose of the temple? Then I wanted to know how they had been prepared for the temple, because I discovered that level of preparation is really core to the kind of initial experience you have, for the most part. And that's not always true for some people. I know some people who have been prepared all their lives and finally go to the temple and still hate it, or have a bad experience, or whatever, just have kind of a whatever experience. Then I wanted to know what people's initial endowment experience was like, and finally, and most importantly, I wanted to know what the effects of the temple were in their lives. So what came out of this was that everybody could repeat verbatim what the purpose of the temple was. It's a place that we go to be closer to God. It's where we go to receive revelation. It's where we go to make covenants. It's, you know, all of those. You think of it, I'm sure you can give me a Sunday school answer. When we talked about level of preparation, again, their answers diverged greatly. Some people had been well prepared, other people had not been prepared at all. As one woman put it, she said, "I think my parents thought it was like sex, that I would just figure it out myself." And that kind of, which is what I almost titled my thesis, but then I thought, no, we won't go there. Another person had been prepared with misinformation. She'd been led to believe she would be running around the temple with absolutely nothing on, which left me with a picture that I really didn't want. I love everyone, but I think we should keep our clothes on. So, for right now, anyway. So just a variety of information. There was one woman who actually felt she was too prepared, and so then as a result, her experience wasn't that great because she wasn't able to engage in some of the self-discovery that we all enjoy. with new and exciting things. So again, it covered a very wide spectrum. My overall conclusion out of preparation is that there needs to be more, because unfortunately it seems to be inadequate overall rather than adequate. So there were places where men and women met and where their experiences were very similar. And those places were in things like, when I go there, I feel the spirit. I go there to receive knowledge. To develop my relationship with God. I have things, a variety of feelings that ranged everywhere from joy to frustration. These were all things that men and women seemed to have in common. But then what happened was they diverged. And this is where the study became interesting, because when I was getting ready to analyze the data and code the data, I wasn't sure how to divide it up. Should I divide it up married versus single? How long it's been since they've been to the temple? Had they been on a mission? Hadn't they? Converts versus, lifelong members? How should I do this? And as the data began to emerge, I realized this had to be discussed on a gender level. Men and women have very different experiences. The men tend to have very textbook experiences, and so you can look at the men's experiences and you feel like you're reading a book about the temple and about what your experience should be with the temple. Now, that said, there were a couple of things, though, where men did struggle with some issues, and those overarching themes were understanding gender roles and cultural constructs. A number of the men that I interviewed, in fact, all of the men that I interviewed, actually showed a surprising amount of intelligence. I'm not sure that's the word I want, but let's just say they weren't stereotypical in their thinking for Mormon men. They tended to grapple with issues that had to do with gender. They saw how their wives and their sisters and their mothers and other women experienced the temple, and they found some disparities, and so they grappled with this and they struggled with this. They struggled with ideas about priesthood and the idea that there's a disparity, that there seems to be a disparity, and that the only way that their priesthood could be whole was in the temple, and that, in fact, the only way their priesthood could be completely whole was in a marriage. So these are some of the things that came out of men's experiences. A number of them talked about their initial endowment experience, about feeling like they were venturing into the unknown, that they hadn't been prepared. One guy compared his experience to being in a car wash. You get in the car wash, and you're just kind of carried along. And when you come out, hopefully the car is sparkly and clean. And that was his experience. He's like, I was just going to be carried along, and I wasn't going to worry about stuff. Others talked about the experience being kind of shocking and having to sort of turn on their faith and go on faith that this would be okay because this is so different, and in fact it's kind of weird, but I've been told that this is good, so I'm going to go on that. My parents have told me that this is a good thing. I'm going to go on that. And eventually what ended up happening was they found themselves kind of caught up in the moment and caught up in the spirit and actually having a good experience. None of the men had bad experiences. The word, too, that came out of their initial experiences regarding the initiatory ordinances was the word intimacy, which is not a very common word in Mormon parlance. We don't use this word because it implies something more than simply multiplying and replenishing the earth. My theory is Mormons don't have sex, they just have children. Because sex would mean that we actually enjoy it. So, and heaven forbid that we do that. Not that I would know, but anyway, since I'm single. I can only go on hypothesis here. Maybe the rest of you can tell me later on, but or maybe not. And finally, so they talked about this intimacy in terms of not being able to ignore what's being said to you because you're having this very one-on-one interaction with another individual. who is standing in as God and representing God. And they saw this as very intimate, which they had not experienced in other settings within Mormonism. And then, as I mentioned earlier, they had an understanding of priesthood that is the salvific understanding of the atonement, how priesthood is tied into the atonement or is the vehicle for atonement. The idea of priesthood in unity, that the man cannot be fully vested in his priesthood without the woman. And then finally, the purity of that power. Now, I should say here as a side note that I am a little hesitant to go into any more about the priesthood because I am a little ambivalent about how we define priesthood. I think our definitions are far too ambiguous. So I didn't go into a lot of that in my thesis. I just let the material stand as it was. That's what they said. That was their reply. I wasn't going to get into, well, do you mean that as a verb, an adjective, a noun, or what? Because I think priesthood in the church versus priesthood in the temple are two often very different manifestations and very different ideas. So I just let the material stand as it was. Finally, men go to the temple because of. They go because of the blessings that are there, because of the knowledge that they can receive, because of whatever. So their reason was more, I'm going to get something out of it, which we'll, in a moment, we'll find was not the case for women. So getting into that, women tended to have different issues, and they're going to seem similar because I'm going to focus on similar things like the initial endowment experience and on things like the priesthood, but their perspectives and their ideas were very different. Most women initial endowment experience was often underlined by stress, anxiety, an expectation of new doctrine, discrepancies from preconceived ideas about ritual, and then some minor things like making sense out of the material that was being presented in light of other material that has been presented previously. So trying to reconcile what they've seen or what they've heard in their church life about ritual and about liturgy. You know, we often tend to criticize our Protestant and Catholic counterparts for being so liturgical and engaging in what we would refer to as pomp and circumstance. And we, you know, we claim not to be interested in any of that or to engage in any of that. And then we go to temple and it's all of this liturgy. So again, trying to reconcile those contradictions was an issue for some women. Women's understanding of the priesthood was fascinating out of the temple. Women clearly understood that, hey, we have priesthood. And they understood this because the language was plain. It was explicit. It was very clear at certain points that women are receiving the priesthood here, and you can't ignore this. You can't miss this. I mean, you'd have to be so engaged in rote, in the roteness or the rote behavior of the ritual that you just completely miss it. Or because you've not heard it all your life within the church as a whole, you're not expecting to hear it here, so you're not going to hear it. But for any of these women who participated in this study, it was very clear that, in fact, when they were in the temple, they were receiving and had priesthood. So this also brought up the issue of if women have priesthood, then why aren't they allowed to exercise it? And again, where this was concerned, I let the material stand as it was. This was what the women told me. This was how they felt, and this is what they experienced when they went to the temple. They also talked about the initiatory ordinances as an experience in empowerment. It was the first time in their church experience, particularly for those who had grown up in the church, where they felt like they were finally being told what was good about being a woman besides just having babies and being a mommy. And that was exciting for them. It was exciting to hear that women can be empowered and are empowered and have the same gifts and blessings given to them as men do. And so there was a real sense of empowerment out of that. The most significant thing that arose out of the women's interviews that never arose in the men's interviews were issues with garments. And I didn't have a question in my interview protocol at all that talked about garments. There was just no question. for that. And this topic arose on its own. Women brought this up on their own. Men did not have an issue with garments, and it never came up in the interviews, with one exception, and that was a young man who was asking me during his follow-up interview what I was discovering from the initial interviews. And I said, well, you know, I'm finding that women have issues with garments and men don't. And he's like, oh, I have issues. And I'm thinking, oh, you know, this will be interesting. Let's see what happens here. Well, his issue was simply that they're poorly made. So while it was a nice issue, and it certainly is a valid one, it wasn't quite applicable. So I mentioned it in a footnote, and then I just sort of scrapped it. So it's here in a footnote, but beyond that, this was an issue specific to women. And that's by no means an indication of, you know, that I footnote men. I don't. But issues about garments I footnote. So their issues were in four areas. They had practical issues. They had issues about sexuality and garments, issues about guarding their garment sacrality, and then a number of other issues, which included, did I get my pagination right? Ah, here we go. Wanting the distinction of garments, or identifying garments with their initial experience. So getting back to the original list that I gave you, because I found this fascinating. I thought this was the most interesting effect that came out of my thesis. The practical issues for women were, again, things like they're poorly made. When I go to tuck it in, it rolls up. You know, I get a wedgie every time I put them on. You know, they're just flat out uncomfortable. They're too hot in the summer. They stretch out. They're poorly made. I would never buy this piece of clothing if I didn't have to, was generally the consensus. Also, women were bothered by the fact that they never had to worry about whether their underwear was short or not. Now they worry about it all the time, you know, and you see women all the time adjusting their skirts, and this skirt, can I, you know, how can I do this? We're actually adjusting my garments because we're not supposed to adjust our garments. So practical issues like that, you know, they'd never had to think before about what they were wearing. And it's not to say that they were out there wearing, you know, whatever. I'm trying to think of the most extreme thing I could wear, a tank top and shorts. Strapless gown, you know, one of the women said that this was difficult for her. She worked in Washington, D.C., and she often would attend formal functions in her job, and she had a hard time finding something that looked elegant without revealing her garments. So practical issues for women. The other thing was sexuality. And again, this is not something that we talk about all that much in Mormon parlance. You know, we don't necessarily talk about our sexuality. We talk about women as in terms of divine womanhood and goddesses in embryo and all of those cliches that we're all familiar with. But we rarely ever talk about our sexuality in terms of being sensual, sentient, sexy people or women. And so a couple of women said that they felt like garments robbed them of their sexuality and of that sense of feeling like a woman and feeling kind of sexy. It's kind of hard to feel sexy in your garments, as I'm sure many of you know. Another concern that arose, and this was more for the two women that I interviewed who were converts and who had not grown up in the church, and so therefore their parents or their families were not members, were guarding their garments' sacrality. And for one woman, this was especially bittersweet because she and her mother, one of the things that they enjoy doing when they get together is going clothes shopping. So, you know, the little trip to Nordstrom or Macy's or Saks or whatever. And in the past, you know, they would go shopping together, and of course they would try on all kinds of clothes, and it didn't matter what they were wearing or that they saw each other's underwear or whatnot. But now she feels inhibited when she goes shopping with her mom. And so it's not something that she enjoys going and doing with her mother, because she feels like her garments are sacred and they are important to her, and it would be devastating, as she put it, to have something that was so meaningful to her not be understood by someone who was also meaningful to her. And so that was a problem. The other woman who had joined the church said that for her, what she felt garments represented to her mother was her mother's loss of her daughter to the church. And she said, you know, I missed a number of opportunities to explain garments to my mother, especially the 60 Minutes interview with Mike Wallace and Steve Young, where Steve Young talked about his garments with Mike Wallace. She said, you know, that would have been an opportunity, or there were a number of other opportunities that she mentioned that unfortunately she didn't take advantage of. And so kind of created a rift between her and her mother, and her mother's feeling that the church had stolen her. And then the last was, as I mentioned, these other perspectives they had, things like one woman who said she actually, this same woman who said that garments created this distance between her and her mother, and her mother thinking that the church, this was one more example of the church taking her away, actually said that she looked forward to going to the temple and getting garments because she wanted that distinction of being Mormon, and for her, garments equaled that distinctiveness. So she was actually glad in that sense to have them because she wanted to be distinct in that way. Another woman talked about her garments in terms of her initial endowment experience, and I know we've all heard stories or have known people like this, but one woman on her initial temple day went to the temple to be married, and her fiancé left her at the altar. And so for her, garments signify that event, and so having to wear them generates for her a considerable amount of resentment. And yet she wears them because she knows it's the right thing to do and because she wants to be faithful. But nevertheless, there's this underlying resentment that, you know, I was left at the altar and now I'm stuck. That was her word. I'm stuck wearing these garments. So that's basically the way I divided up my data. You know, they didn't tell me how much time I had. Does anyone know? Okay, well, we'll just keep going until they tell us to stop. That was essentially the data that was gathered and that was analyzed. There were some limitations to the study, some of them being that, again, would people participate? Would they be willing to participate? And would they give me straightforward, honest answers? And I would have to say that, yes, in fact, every single person that participated did not give me a Sunday school answer or was not trying to portray themselves as the good and perfect Mormon. I believe some of the contributions of this study are in the area of qualitative studies. Again, interviewing people and actually getting their stories, hearing their stories. I think there's a great deal to be said for qualitative research, that I've done it, as painful as it was. And I think this is something that, again, as I said earlier, I love the temple and I love going to the temple. And I think the temple is at the core of our identity. It's been a part of Mormon identity since essentially the inception of the church. And it's something that we continue to engage in. I think the most stunning and intriguing announcement of the last 18 months is the fact that the church is rebuilding the temple in Nauvoo. I think there are some huge implications involved in that, and most of them lie in how we identify ourselves. I kind of see that as becoming the second Mecca for Mormonism. And so, you know, the temple is incredibly significant in the lives of Mormons, and I think it's what motivates and moves us more than anything, whether we've been or not, because the goal, if we haven't been, is that we will go. And if we have been, it's that we'll live our lives so that we can continue to go and so that we can obtain the blessings that we've been promised there, and that is, you know, exaltation, becoming gods, so forth. So more than any other part of Mormon theology, Mormon culture, Mormon life, Mormon sociology, I think the temple is one of the core manifestations of Mormon faith that that really needs to be discovered or needs to be discussed more openly. I will say this, that my thesis does not talk about what goes on in the temple. I do not give you a description of what goes on there. I don't give you a drawing of, if you want that, you know, there are numerous sources online where you can get that. Sandra and Gerald Tanner have done us all an enormous favor by doing that for us. And so that information is available there. My thesis is about how the temple affects people's lives, and whether it makes a difference or not in their lives. So, aside from that, I think that's all I have right now. Jeff?
Having never responded to a paper before, this is a bit of a surprise or a new experience for me. But first, I think your idea, Janet, for retitling your thesis is a good idea. And I was sort of penciling a couple of thoughts there. I thought we could call it "The Temple Like Sex." You'll figure it out. And I'm sure you'd sell more when you publish it. But so I think in my response, I first of all should say that I had an opportunity to read Janet's thesis, and it is really, really fine work, which I didn't tell you, but it's just very well written. And I don't know what the long-term plans are of it, if you do plan to publish it or whatnot. To hide when she's done. but it's really worthwhile. And I think my response isn't anything in terms of being a critique or anything of that nature, because I think what she's done here is really is great work. And that's one of the things that I like so much about Sunstone, is an opportunity to talk about some of the things that we don't necessarily get a chance to talk about in Sunday school or in priesthood meeting or whatever the case may be. And in fact, I think it's important sometimes that we have divisions about where we talk about certain kinds of things. I don't know that talking about all the ramifications of the Mormon Meadows Massacre in Sunday school is necessarily a faith-building thing. And I think it's important that Sunday church services are about building our faith. But there were a couple of things that I thought I would bring up in terms of my own experiences with the temple, and then hopefully some of you might have some questions that you'd like to ask Janet, and we can discuss some of that for a minute. First of all, in terms of when she opens her thesis, she talks about the experience of an 18-year-old woman going to the temple. And as she went to the temple, she was not very well prepared for what would be happening. Probably like most of us, she'd been told to be a spiritual experience and a wonderful experience and all of that. And when she got there, it was not that kind of an experience for her at all. Later, this woman, 22 years later or 30 years later or something like that, she went to the temple with her own daughter, who I guess was about 22, preparing to go on a mission. And this daughter of 22 had apparently had about the same kind of preparation, which I think tells us all something. And when
The daughter had had better preparation. The daughter's best friend had had similar preparation
to what the mother had had. Good, thanks. And the daughter had a much more positive experience. In fact, almost the opposite of what the mother had. And I think those of us that have gone to the temple can plot ourselves along the paradigm of where we fit, what our experience was like as compared to what maybe some of our friends were, or even converts, and we've gone to the temple and welcomed them into the celestial room, and some of them come out with their eyes very big and think, you know, what did I do? And I think that's important, and Janet acknowledges that in her thesis. And I also think in terms of the way we experience the temple, it's important to recognize that we all have different experiences. One of Janet's sort of main thrusts that she didn't really hit on a lot here is that we could do a better job in preparing people to go to the temple. And I'd be interested, as we open it up to questions, to hear some of your thoughts on that, if in fact you think that is the case. I felt like sort of the three things that people told me to prepare me for the temple was don't laugh at the naked people, don't fall off the goat, and don't volunteer for the virgin. That was one of my friends who you know, was a term missionary and a bit of a smart aleck, to say the least. So I didn't do any of those things, and I had a really great experience.
What I'd like to know is, what are those things?
You haven't gone down to the underground rooms yet.
No,
yeah. that comes once you get the priesthood. But one of the things that Janet points out in her why did they call me to be Elder's Quorum president? You know, they're asking for a problem, weren't they? One of the things Janet points out is the difference, which I found quite fascinating, was the gender issues between the men and the women's responses. The men's being somewhat closer to the Orthodox religion, to quote something that some of us might remember from the old days in the temple. And that being a certain response that men had, that we sort of moved ourselves to having the right response. I don't know if any of you have read a paper, and Janet, you would be interested, I think, in this, two papers, one by Beverly Campbell and one by Claire Johnson, which were published probably 10 years ago in the, it used to be run by BYU, but it's called the Collegium Escalapium, which is an organization for Mormon physicians and folks in the medical profession. But they have two really great papers on the role of Eve. As a filmmaker, I've often thought if I had a chance to ever direct the Temple film, and if they ever choose to do a new one, not that they'd ever ask someone with long hair to do such a thing, but if I would that would be one of the things that I would really like to work with, is the way that Eve is portrayed. She doesn't have very many lines, but from the way that she's portrayed, and I think that there has been an improvement from the two older films from the 60s to I think it was 89 or 90 when they revamped a lot of that. But still, unfortunately, when you hear especially women talk about the Temple films, you never talk about who plays Satan or any of that. It's always, oh, it's the blonde-haired Eve one. That's the one that we saw. And as big a fan as I am of film, I think there's something to be said for a live session. And Janet also talks about this in her thesis. And if you've gone to the Salt Lake Temple, or if you've ever gone to a live session, and if you haven't, I really recommend that. I have gone where Elohim has been played by an old Tongan brother, and he has happened to be there a couple times when I've gone, and the way he says the things is so moving to me, and he interprets it in a very different way, whereas when you go with the recorded film, there's sometimes a tendency on my part to sort of start to want to automatically go to sleep. And that's because it's the same thing every time we go. Even though it's the same thing in Salt Lake as well, it's the same thing but different, which is something that you can only get with a live experience. Also, Janet talks about this gender difference between men and women. She brings up the possibility of men going through the priesthood and going from a deacon to a teacher to a priest and so forth. Whereas in the young women's program, it's not quite the same way. We men get to pass the sacrament, and then we get to officiate in a certain way, and then we get to bless the sacrament. And Mom served on first or the second council in the general young women's presidency of the church, and talked about there's a secret society of sociologists that work in the church that do all kinds of studies. And none of which are available to the rest of us, but making this transition for young women is one of the very toughest transitions that goes on in the church. And I wonder what kind of collaboration or corroboration, I should say, there is between that data and what we've seen with people's experiences in the temple. And that would be interesting, I think, to further study. Janet also makes certain recommendations for further studies, which I think would be wonderful, and I don't want to take much more time because I want to give you an opportunity to ask Janet some questions and of course if there's anything that I can throw in, I'm happy to do that. She also talked about with women and their experience with garments in terms of the sacrality, if I'm saying that correct, and a new word for me because I had always just said sacredness, but sacrality, I can beat my wife in Scrabble now, a sociology term, and it reminded me of in terms, especially in terms of converts with their families, seeing their garments and what kind of experience that is. A good friend of ours is from Spain, and she went back to visit her family in Spain, you know, as you do, she washed her clothes and so forth at her parents' house. And when she got back to the U.S., she realized she'd left two pairs of her garments in Madrid. And she didn't know quite what to do, if she should call and say, would you send them back to me? Or But her mother and sister called and said, "We love these new pajamas that you've left here, and we just don't know where to find more of them. But they're so comfortable, and what is it that we need? You know, could you order some more for us?" And so that's, you know, an option maybe that none of us have thought about and one other thing in terms of the quality control at Beehive. When my mom was on the general board of the Relief Society, she talked about how people would show up to Sister Jack, or the people would send their garments to Eaton Jack and say, you know, "My right leg is 15 inches and my left leg is 8. What is the problem?" And you know, being a man, I guess the only solution I could come up with that is that since Beehive has a monopoly, we should all buy stock in it. And then, you know, we could all have a part of that that garment making enterprise that they have going up there. So I want to turn the time back to Janet, and maybe I can sort of help point out questions if anybody has questions that they'd like to ask her about some of the things that she discovered. Yeah.
You talked about the extraordinary factors of temple worship and mentioned one of the things that it had to be logistically different or far away. I'm wondering what impact that we're going to have with all the little temples going in that make it so convenient for people to go to temple. Do you think that will impact the process?
I've been asked to make sure to repeat the question for the tape. The question is the increase in temple building going to blow my theory out of the water? In the sense that one of the elements of extraordinary worship is that it has to be inaccessible. You know, I was actually thinking this the other night, and someone asked me a very similar question. And I think the answer is no. And I think that in the Catholic sense, in the sense that in the Catholic Church we have parishes that we can go to, but there are very few cathedrals. Now, granted, or actually I'll use the Episcopal model because that's the seminary that I attend in at the Graduate Theological Union, and they also have cathedrals. In Northern California alone, I can get a cathedral in San Francisco, one in Sacramento, and I think that's it. But there are two, which within a three-hour driving time is, you know, that's quite a lot. I mean, I can be to a cathedral in less than an hour and a half. But that doesn't change the fact that there is something extraordinary about that particular building. It's the seat of the episcopate, of the bishop of the diocese. And so the church's drive, of course, is that the temple will be more accessible to members, that it will be easier to get to. But it remains extraordinary. Things that go on there are very different. They're very different buildings. They're not meant to look like your typical church building, with the exception now, of course, of the mini temples that they're building. My aunt attends a ward in Salt Lake City that eventually will be converted into a mini temple. And again, I can find the bathroom in that building, no problem. But then, with all theories, there are holes. And I expect my theory to have holes blown in it. And this will be the major hole, is that the church is increasing construction. Yes?
I wonder if let me just preface this question. When I went to the temple in 1989, I was getting ready for my mission. And before going on my mission, I went initially to the Salt Lake Temple, Black Section, and then in the MCC several times. I was there for 2 months for four lectures in Provo. And you know, I thought a lot about the way that the temple was there in Provo at that time, and about, you know, had I really committed myself to do the things that I was being asked to do. And when I got back, a lot of those things were missing from the ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered the first time I went to the temple after I got back if I had remembered it correctly. But I'm wondering if in your study you had people comment about the differences, whether they were positive or negative, or whether it was easy to accept afterwards.
The question is, did the change in the temple ceremony affect people's experiences? Did any of the participants talk about whether changes in the ceremony had affected their experiences? One of the reasons I chose the congregations that I chose is because I wanted to talk to people who had been to the temple pre-1990 and those who had been there post, and kind of make a comparison between what was and now what is. Unfortunately, I didn't have it. I would say easily 95% of the people that I talked to had been to the temple after the thing had changed. One had been prior to the change, and it was again because he was going on a mission, and so he had been in 1989, but then the temple changed, and so he hadn't been enough to make that distinction. So it became irrelevant, and I didn't even talk about it in my thesis because there was nothing to talk about, really. Yes?
I was particularly interested in what you said about women and the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
I've always believed that women have as much responsibility to the priesthood as men, particularly in view of what it says in Section 131,
mm-hmm.
that in temple marriage, the woman and the man enter into an order of the priesthood. Is that how you feel?
The question is, do I feel that women have priesthood as understood in Doctrine and Covenants 131 and as it's seen in the temple? Right. Do I... Right. Right. My belief is that women do have a responsibility. However, I would prefer not to answer that question on the record. So I would talk to you off the record. Yes? The question is, in what way is temple participation worship? That's a really good question. You know, because again, we don't have this liturgical heritage in our church where we actually get together and worship in that very Pentecostal, charismatic, hands raised, voices raised, praise God kind of way. With music and right. So, you know, but then we're also not coming together and lifting up prayers to a particular deity. So in the traditional sense of our understanding of worship, it really isn't. But I think in the Mormon understanding, it's very different from what we would classify as general worship. You know, we go to church on Sunday to worship God and to partake of the sacrament and make the atonement effectual in our lives. When we go to the temple, we're worshiping God in a new form. And I think one of the problems is that the term temple worship has become rather cliche. And I'll admit that I used it in that very cliche way in this thesis as well. And to be really honest, I don't know what we mean by that. That's a very good question. Somebody want to figure that out and write a paper?
I think one part of that is the notion that you point out. Communion that we have with God in the temple, which I think is a different kind of worship than in terms of being able to be there to reflect and to think about the way your relationship with God and vice versa.
Okay, one last question and then we'll wrap up.
Statistical analysis viewpoint, to what extent do you think that your conclusions are valid based upon what I think I understood to be a response from 12 people?
Mm-hmm.
It all sounded right to me, but it sounds like such a small sampling.
The question is, how do I think my conclusions are valid? Is that?
In a broader sense, is this more broad?
No, and this is one of the things that I discuss in my limitations. The sample is not broad. The sample is specifically young adult Mormons between the ages of 21 and 35. This topic is tenuous. People won't talk about it. I think these people chose to talk about it for a variety of reasons. One was their age. The other is that the majority of them were college students, and so it's normal for college students to engage in critical analysis and to talk about things in a very critical, analytical way. So the study has its limitations. I mean, if people won't talk about the topic, then I can't really, you know, give conclusive or draw conclusive conclusions, definitive conclusions. I'm not sure what the word is I want. Thank you. So, in that sense, weak. I mean, all I have to go on is based on the experience of 21 to 35-year-olds, which I have to say, for the most part, in talking with most 21 to 35-year-olds, is the experience. And so I could conclusively say that, you know, most young people grapple with this. But I think you also get to a point where you reach a certain age where you finally settle into it and you're okay with it. But I would have liked to know that. You know, I would have liked to have heard those voices. So the next time a graduate student decides to do a study on this, please, all of you that are over 35, please, please, take the risk and participate. It's well worth it. I enjoyed thoroughly my research. It was hard. It took me 4.5 years. But then, there were a variety of circumstances. Life happens as you're doing other things. But I learned so much, and I enjoyed so much watching these people share their faith with me, struggle with their faith, and yet come to the conclusion that it's going to be okay, and this is a good thing. So thank you again.
I'd like to thank Jenna and Jeff for speaking today, and also thank all of you for coming. Please enjoy the rest of the conference.
Jeff, thank you.
Oh, so very nice.